The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, is everyone coming back in? Break between these two consecutive panels. So we're going to start up again. And we're going to try to build on what has been covered already in this program today, most particularly in the past panel, talking about transparency worldwide, and focus on the role that the U.S. has played, is playing now, and perhaps can play in the future as transparency replaces secrecy, as the Bush administration policies give way in due course. It takes some time to the Obama administration transparency policies. And to address that, we have one of the members of the CGS Advisory Board, Kevin Goldberg, who's been very, very active in international transparency, in transparency in general, as well as in areas of international transparency for quite some time. Kevin is sort of the go-to guy for news media organizations because he's, pardon?
Just, yeah, my go-to. A go-to guy. Okay. Plenty of people that could do this just as well.
Sorry. I said sort of the go-to guy. Lucy's not here to contradict me, so even though she's another member of our advisory board, CGS is Lucy Doglish of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. And Kevin has spoken in our panels before. He's both an attorney and an aficionado of openness in government, to say the least. And then to his left is Kevin, pardon me, is John Burdi. I'm pronouncing that correctly, I think, John.
That's correct.
John is with a real successful organization, an NGO. We used to call them public interest groups. Then the phrase was more popular, NGO, non-government organization. That's something that was used overseas, I think, before the United States. So just at the point at which we in the U.S. finally adopted NGO as a replacement for public interest groups, then along came the phrase civil society organizations. And you heard reference to that today. Well, the Electronic Privacy Information Center has been one of the leading civil society organizations, so to speak, in this country. And they were also very actively involved in litigation of Freedom of Information Act cases. And as a matter of fact, that's John's strong point. He is our both senior counsel and director of the Open Government Project at EPIC, and also has been involved in litigating quite a few Freedom of Information Act cases, and is one of those people who now is looking for the Obama Justice Department to take a new stance, sort of walk the walk, not just talk the talk, with respect to new openness policy and applying the foreseeable harm standard even to cases that are now pending in court.
That would be nice.
That would be nice, yes. We sure did that back in 1993 when we implemented the comparable Reno policy, the one that's comparable to the Holder openness and government policy. It happened then, it just hasn't been happening quite yet now, this time around. And certainly not least, but last, at the end, is Miriam Nisbet, who has held a number of very high-level related positions in this area. Going backwards consecutively, she joins us now, having just recently been the director of the Information Society Division of UNESCO in Paris for 2 years. She and my wife can speak French a lot better than Miriam and I can. And prior to that, she was with the American Library Association, the ALA, for about 8 years as legislative counsel, legislative director, or the like. Prior to that, going back earlier in her career, she started when she was just 8 years old, I think. Miriam started with the Justice Department in 1978. And I first came to know her not long after that, and then when Miriam was Deputy Director of the Office of Information Privacy from July of 1982. I remember that was a rainy day that that started, but the sun shines clear very quickly until I lost her. Jacob and I lost her to an SES position at the National Archives and Records Administration that she held for a number of years before she went to the ALA. And I'm not done yet. And now, for the last, well, I made the mistake of saying 3 weeks, and Miriam corrected me, you know, it's only 20 days, because it will be 3 weeks until tomorrow. For almost the past 3 weeks, Miriam has been the new founding director of the new Office of Government Information Services, OGIS for short, which was created by the FOIA Amendments of 2007, again technically taking effect January 1, 2008, but without any funding. Finally, with funding, the office was created on the very day that Miriam could be persuaded to leave Paris to come back to the United States and take on the job of being director of that office. And Miriam has already learned in the past 20 days that, as far as NARA was concerned, that when this legislation was passed to create this ombudsman office in NARA, they quickly concluded that OGIS stand for Oh God, I Screwed, because they had the responsibility but not the money. But now that is all changing, because Miriam is there and they have some funding, and they're going to do a terrific job of providing the function that many other nations of the world have, as you've heard us talk about today. As one gentleman mentioned, it is commonly the case in Pakistan, where there is an ombudsman function that is performed, and performed very effectively. And that's going to be Miriam's task. So she is sort of a double threat for us. She both recently can speak from the standpoint of civil society, so to speak, from the European perspective about the United States, and she's now part of the solution, so to speak. She's not a political appointee of the Obama administration. I want to make that very clear, even if Miriam does it. She was indeed a member of the transition team, but she holds a career senior executive position, and I sure hope they gave you an ES6, because you certainly deserve it for the position you now hold. So what I'm going to do with that lengthy introduction, you guys don't mind, I hope that I kind of played up Miriam a little bit more than you guys. Yeah, okay. I did tell that joke, Kevin, this morning about getting dispensation from the Vatican. And I said, for enough shekels, they would, never mind. Okay. I'm going to turn you over to Kevin, who's going to start us off as we focus on the restoration of the U.S. leadership role worldwide.
Thanks, Dan. I assume that you're in keeping in tune with last panel's discussion of pro rata share and amount of discussion, that since you introduced Miriam for twice as long, she has to speak twice as long as either of us.
I thought you were going to argue in the other direction.
No, thank you. No.
I think he took some of my time.
Well, frankly, I sometimes wonder what I'm up here speaking about, because I don't consider myself necessarily as much of an expert as Miriam. I've never worked overseas on these issues. I'm domestic-based. I've never litigated any of these cases like John. I certainly haven't traveled to as many countries as Tom Blanton has, though you did once say I was almost as energetic a speaker as he is, and I think that's why he put me right after.
I think you're pretty darn close, yes.
And I will admit, yes, I'm not anywhere but here today. And I was driving up past Washington Hebrew on the way, and it took me, I'll ashamedly admit, it took me a second to wonder why so many people are outside today. Yeah. So I guess what I'll talk about, though, are my own impressions from having worked on behalf of a major news media organization here as to how the news media plays a role in, or the components that are unique in the United States with regard to the news media that play a role in restoring U.S. leadership in these areas overseas, and my own impressions in terms of what I've seen on various trips overseas to different countries. I mean, I've been to the worst of the worst offenders in terms of freedom of expression and open government issues. And I've been to some that clearly have invited us here. I mean, I've been invited to their country because they want to model themselves on us. So I'm going to talk primarily about where I see our stature right now, and then follow that up with some ideas as to how we can restore that leadership role, and specifically, again, in a couple areas that I think might be a little different, perhaps, than just the straight-up open government laws, looking at the laws and the functioning of the processing. And to start, I would say, in terms of what I generally see, I mean, we've had a lot of discussion here at other conferences. Everybody that works on these issues in their daily lives will see what we do right and do wrong. But I think it was, it was stated in the last panel that we are basically still at the top. The United States is still the leader in terms of who other countries look to on freedom of expression and open government issues for the most part, at least the ones that we think we could actually change. I mean, I talked about the worst of the worst. Look, I've been to Cuba, I've been to Venezuela. Nothing we do is going to bring them into the fold. So I think you can pretty much write that off. But, you know, for a lot of the countries we probably do want to be reaching out to, it's clear. The proof is there that these people will take our advice, our goals, our models, and put them to use. And even in some instances, even put them to better use. I'll point out, I was in Swaziland last year, and I've continued to keep up. There's a very good website, Swazi Media Commentary. It's at swazimedia.blogspot.com, and it's written by a professor at a university down there, basically the only university down there that has covered these issues. And, you know, and he notes in the last, actually on January 21, that, the game is up for the Swazi elite, that they wanted to come back into the fold for so long, and they've been pushed out of the fold for so long. Well, now's their chance. And as he says, the King Muswati, has for many years longed to get a face-to-face meeting with the United States president. I mean, here's the only king in sub-Saharan Africa. And all he really wants, he's rejected meetings with U.S. representatives. He wants to meet the president, our president. And I think, there's still, the world's still looking to us, and it's certainly true for FOI. We've seen that many of the laws, when you look at the text, many laws still have the basic condition, structure, and language of the United States Freedom of Information Act. For better or worse, if we've seen any implementation, they still are looking to us. They're not just cribbing, but outright copying our law, and maybe in some of the better instances, the easier copying in better instances, adding to it by adding a judiciary or congressional component, which is nice. Reference was made as well in the last panel to South Africa. Well, I know how South Africa and some of the other Southern African countries were able to draft their laws. They sent people to the U.S. or had people come in from the U.S. and from the United Kingdom and work with them on drafting their laws. Those were the two major points of consultation that I was told. And we see that major international programs that started primarily in the U.S. are catching on very well. I mean, it's a shame that we aren't going to have Deb Gersh Hernandez running Sunshine Week next spring, because she took that thing international. I mean, she was doing radio interviews from Spain. She was being invited to the Carter Center Conference in Peru. She had gone beyond the borders. And International Rights in O'Day, I got another email this morning saying there's a big celebration going on at this event in Spain. And, these are things that are primarily coming out of the United States, first and foremost, and being adopted by other countries. Now, so we clearly are a leader. How much influence are we having? Well, I did promise to shock. I don't know how shocking it is, but by comparison purposes, these are two pictures I took overseas in the last 5 years. This was a T-shirt. That one speaks for itself, with the S in the swastika, the swastika in the S.
Well, I can read it on the other side.
And this one was taken about 5 years ago in the Palermo district of Buenos Aires, and it says Bush hijo de mil puta, and basically that the Bush is spelled with an S, so I'm not sure if the person hated Bush beer or the president. Either way, I'm with him, by the way, or her. But basically, I mean, it says Bush is a son of a thousand bitches. Well, there's no place to go but up from there, okay? Let's start with that as a pretty good point. And then you bring into the fact that you bring into the new administration. And I was, as I said, I was in Swaziland last year, and I was in Zambia as well. And I was there in Zambia the week that Hillary Clinton basically conceded the Democratic nomination. And I'm talking to people, and all they want to talk about is the U.S. election. All they want to talk about is Obama. They're staying up until 3 in the morning watching election coverage on CNN International every night. I'm like, I can't find 5 friends who watched anything about the election yesterday. But they are Obama mad. And of course, this isn't a surprise to anyone. But clearly, right there, it's like, okay, strike while the iron is hot. Is the message. And it is carrying over. I've kept up on the Zambia Post had a great column, well, just a few weeks ago, where the writers, he titles it Freedom of Information Now. And he writes, I'll just quote a little bit of it, he has 5 sort of messages for people in government or in the community to demand from their government. He writes, the second thing is for government ministries and departments to become proactively transparent in their deeds. They need not wait nor indeed dread the Auditor General's annual reports. In the age of internetization, government bodies can publish online, monthly or quarterly perhaps, details of their financial incomes and expenditures for people to see. Zambia must run an open government. Here perhaps we can learn from President Barack Obama.
On his first full day in office, President Barack Obama issued an executive order and several memoranda on transparency. His open government agenda has six key features, five of which are relevant to the Zambian situation. I mean, they really are. And the Lagos Independent, Daily Independent, has a very similar article where they're talking about the economy, but then they say the new atmosphere has been recreated on other fronts. One of his first acts on the first day of office was to extend the scope of Freedom of Information Act as it affects the federal government. This act of extending openness in the process of governance should be food for thought to those in Nigeria who cannot countenance the enactment of the Freedom of Information Act. Obama sensibly ordered. So he goes on to talk about some of the other things, the closure of Guantanamo Bay. But again, the point is clear that the world still is looking to America to tell, you know, guide them. Well, that means how do we figure out how to do it right? Maybe it's because I was in Las Vegas last weekend.
Aren't you ever home either?
I take slightly less exotic vacations or trips than Tom does.
I would dare say there's probably very little point in time where you, Tom Blanton, and Professor Horsley are in the United States simultaneously.
I wish I were traveling as much as them. But I was there, and I started thinking about this in terms of poker. You look over your cards, you're playing Texas Hold'em, and if you poker players, the term, you know, you look up, and, or non-poker players, I should say, the term will be slow play the hands. You who are poker players, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You look at two aces, you realize you have the best hand going, and if you suddenly shove all your chips in and push forward, everybody else runs away. No. You make them think they're doing all the work, and suddenly you benefit off of it. That's what I'm thinking. I think Miriam will agree in terms of her experience at UNESCO that the best way to get people to run from anything the U.S. says is to force it upon them. Anytime when I was working with the World Press Freedom Committee on a lot of issues overseas, the quickest thing I learned was never come in as the American perspective. That's almost like, you know, we in America do this, so this ought to work. It's worked for us, it will work for you. Well, there are many problems with that. But clearly my work has led me to believe that you can't simply say it's worked for us and it will work for you. And part of the reason is that, these countries don't have the ability to do what we do. They don't have the ability and they don't have the governance that wants to simply follow. Okay, they do, as emerging nations, want to do their own thing. We did hear again just recently about how so many countries don't have the necessary technology to effectuate the access to information ideals that we have and that even they have. Well, another issue is many of them don't have the culture or the educational abilities to cover this. In many African nations, you've got a literacy rate hovering at about 50, 60, 70%. You know, how is someone going to use a Freedom of Information Act if they can't read the records they have requested or can't even write the request?
YouTube.
Yeah, well, seriously, these are some of the things we've got to think about. And in some cultures, I mean, in Swaziland, part of the problem was even more basic than that. There are two kinds of law. There is Swaziland law, and there is Swazi tribal custom. And Swazi tribal custom is a very oral tradition. They don't write things down. It's decided that they don't want to write things down because they want to be able to pass things on from generation to generation. A noble ideal in keeping Swazi culture going, but it doesn't translate well into a Freedom of Information. So again, our one-size-fits-all doesn't work. And forcing our ideals on them, at least in the case of this one very, 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 very small and remote example, is probably going to push the tribal elders away. So we've got to figure out a better way to do it. And to me, that means playing up other aspects that are designed to bring people into the fold as an overall mindset. One of which is my exception to trying to force ideals, American ideals, on them. One thing we do need to promote is freedom of speech. We've always tried to separate Freedom of Information Act from the First Amendment in this country. They are clearly different under law. They clearly have some interrelatedness, however, as well. And I think that what we need to do is make sure that in many of these countries, that people, when they do have the ability to get the information, have the ability to use it as well. You've got countries that still have criminal penalties for defamation. You still have countries that still punish insults, criticism, opinionated criticism or true criticism of the heads of state. And all, again, that alone is a deterrent to asking for information. Because once you have the information, you have to make that second decision. Do I want to use it? Okay? And that's very difficult. So we need to be supporting all of these. One area, again, that's very, very often discussed is healthcare and public health. And in Swaziland, they have the highest HIV infection rate in the world, 33%. Okay? 33% of the population, you know, it kind of was that bad joke, and it's made worse here from law school. Like the first day of law school, what's the person on your left? What's the person on your right? Well, one of them will not be here when you graduate. Well, in Swaziland, that is translated to one of those people has HIV. Okay, think about that for a second. On this panel, one of the four of us, if we were Swazi residents, would have HIV.
I've been tested. I don't know.
And it's funny because the royal family, the king has 14 wives. One out of three has HIV in the population. 14 wives. Nobody's talking about the question that's not being asked there. Which of those 14, if any? Okay, because they don't want to. And I heard from so many people at the U.S. Embassy, if we felt we could talk about this openly, especially about the royal family, when you know it's the subcurrent of everything that's going on, well, that would make it easier for people to talk about their open lives. And so these are real, you know, and again, and that makes it easier to ask for the information from government as well. And so these are real examples of how the supporting notion of freedom of speech is useful. The next area is now moving away again from just open government into area one that we just talked about a second ago, training for legal change. One thing that was mentioned was the need for an independent system of oversight as to any law. I mean, thankfully, we're gonna have Marin doing a lot of that for us here. Well, it is necessary anywhere else. And I think we need to, in all of our programs, we have these legal training programs. I think it would be very useful to promoting the use of Freedom of Information Acts worldwide. Dick Schmidt, my predecessor as legal counsel of the American Society of News Editors, used to say the strongest thing this country has ever produced was the independent federal judiciary. I think we need to instill that idea in everybody as well. And finally, lobbying in this area. There's a remarkable, in countries outside the United States, even with the growth of civil society, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, there's a remarkable lack of knowledge about how to build a coalition of people, how to get a message out, and how to make that message resonate with a legislator. I always like to say that, well, of course, you know, government officials are going to want to keep free speech. Are going to want to keep secrets. And of course, the media will certainly advocate for free speech. Well, you're going to win that battle by winning the people. Whichever side you get them over is likely to end up winning the free speech versus secrecy battle. And I think that we don't have the savvy in many of these countries outside the United States as to how to promote that argument. And largely because, as I said before, in many of these countries, there is not the literacy rate or the education. So a lot of it falls to the media. And that's my next area. I think we need to not only promote legal training, we need to do a better job of, self-interested here, promoting journalism training and the basic knowledge of people of how to be a reporter. They're still dealing very much in basic media. They're still dealing in many of these countries outside the U.S. in newspaper, television, and of course, because of the lack of literacy in many of these countries, community radio is huge. But they don't quite understand how to present investigative reporting. And the more we can do with U.S. programs to teach, not force, teach the basic skills, I think that the more we will see the actual value pay off. I went in, when I was in Zambia, I woke up and I was reading the paper during breakfast one day, and I just looked at the front page and saw five stories, any one of which could have been made better through the use of some sort of open government law, especially at the local level. And I incorporated that day into my lectures, and especially with journalism students, you know, you sort of had this blank look. They still didn't quite get it. Okay, well, there was an article here about a traffic accident at a certain corner. And then it said that there had been three accidents at the same corner a month ago. Well, the first thing that screamed out to me was a good journalist would go and try to get the police reports and figure out, was there any interconnection? Was it 1, 2, 3, or 4 bad drivers? Or is there some inherent danger with that corner that we're not seeing? Okay, were there, 10 accidents in the 2 years before that? they didn't quite get that. And I was told by the embassy people that these are basic skills that are lacking, the ability or insight to ask these questions and find out where they can get the answers. So you're not only hampered by a fear of asking, but by an innate lack of ability to ask the questions in many instances. So if we can put these resources in there, from the United States, into training people, whether it be through the programs that are already involved, in place. The International Center for Journalists is doing a great job of training people here and overseas, through our nonprofits, or even our State Department. We have the program that every embassy has it in their budget to do programs. That's how I was over in Africa. That's how I've done other trips. And I know other people in this room have as well. I'm pretty sure that at least two or three of you have done a speakers and specialist type program where you go for a week, you work with legislators, you work with judges, you work with news media, and you work with students. And you try to teach them about our law. You don't force, but you try to teach. And I would love to see us sort of try to push, internally, I think the last recommendation I had is maybe push the State Department to try to get their embassies to understand these programs even better. It doesn't necessarily mean sending people overseas anymore. It can be video conferencing. Still like free trips when I can get them. But I think that we, internally what we need to do is look at how, again, not forcing, but teaching our people, teaching through our practices can effectuate the change that people need to do better with the records they're eventually going to get. So with that, I'll turn it over to John.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kevin.
Picking up where Kevin left it off, I think that one of the things that the United States needs to do in this administration is lead by example. And I understand that going, I take Kevin's point, I take it seriously, that internationally, one of the worst things you can do is walk into a room and say, this is how you do it, this is how you ought to do it. Having said that, you also don't want to be open to the criticism of, we've reached a consensus in this room on how we're going to do things overseas. The United States seems to be part of that consensus. Why aren't you doing that? Why aren't you meeting these bare minimum requirements at home in your own system, in this supposedly advanced system that everyone is looking to? So what I'm going to do is talk very briefly about what I have seen from the Obama administration on these issues and where I think this could go in a positive direction and where I fear it might go in a negative direction. First of all, I think that the real basis and the lesson that can be taken from the activity between February and now is that the administration has promulgated a very good statement in February, first day in office, excellent principles. There was a process by which those principles are going to be formalized within the administration. So a good executive order, that's all well and good. The second thing is that it's very clear both from the administration's words and from their actions that they are going to take advantage of technology, that they're going to take advantage of Web 2.0 tools. There are some dangers to this, but there are also real opportunities in this. And I think I'm going to suggest that the opportunities are probably larger than the dangers. Certainly, you'd rather have the former than the latter. In terms of new developments, one of the biggest new developments is the automatic disclosure of White House visitor records. These are records that have been the subject of lawsuits over and over consistently by a number of different groups for years. They're oft-litigated. The basic idea is that there is a public interest in who is going to the White House to meet with top-level officials. Administrations have typically been very resistant to releasing these sorts of records, and the lawsuits have met with varying degrees of success. Even when the lawsuits have been successful in forcing disclosure of the records, those disclosures have often come very long after the FOIA process was initiated. The White House has committed at this stage to, as a matter of course, releasing all but the most sensitive of these records. And the way it was explained to us is that the most sensitive of these records, one example would be the meeting between between the president and a prospective Supreme Court nominee. And the records of that meeting would be released, but at some time after the issue was resolved and the nomination was no longer passed. So that's a big deal, and it's a big deal for a couple of reasons. One, it means that the Center for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington can stop suing for these records every 2 years. But two, it's an example of how the administration has committed to these Web 2.0 tools. This data isn't just being released in paper. paper form, and you can go by the office of the executive and pick it up if you want one. We have searchable versions of this. We have versions in an Excel spreadsheet that are being posted. It's being posted timely, and it's being posted as a matter of course. And what that means is, when Tom Blanton talks about objective information and data sets and letting loose 1,000 grad students on some of this information to do some analysis, well, now we have some actual basis for analysis. And that's a very, very good thing. There are certainly some privacy concerns here in terms of, you know, folks who are visiting the White House. But by and large, in terms of disclosure, this is a big win. So it's an example of what the administration could be doing moving forward. And what other areas could benefit from this sort of automatic, searchable, databaseable, spreadsheetable disclosure? Well, you know, there's a lot of areas, and I'm sure folks in this room have their own list. But one thing that we've been involved in are reports to congressional oversight committees. These are reports that are often mandated by statute. They're on occasion mandated by regulation. And typically, these reports are produced by executive agencies on an annual basis. They're sent to congressional oversight committees. They contain no or virtually no classified material. And yet, the agency that produces the report and the congressional committee that receives the report fail to post this information for the public. Now, you can acquire this information through the FOIA if you'd like to litigate the issue for a year or two and get stale data. Or you could go to one of a few shiny examples. And in this case, I would look at some of the data that's collected by the Department of Justice regarding the Wiretap Act. Federal wiretaps are compiled by the judges who issue the wiretap orders. And by statute, they are required to be distributed by the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts. Those are published on a regular basis. They're published in the same format every year, which means you can A/B data year to year. You have common definitions, and they're published timely. So that's a really good thing. Now, that data relates to federal wiretaps. There's another class of federal electronic surveillance data that relates to orders that are called pen trap orders. It's not terribly important for the purpose of this conversation what pen trap orders are, but suffice to say they're a very specific sort of electronic surveillance information that is distinct from a wiretap order. These pen trap orders are also counted up by the Department of Justice every year. The Attorney General develops a report that's the same year to year. You can A/B the data, and it's submitted to the congressional oversight committees. Yet, this data is not released to anyone, as a matter of course. None of it is classified. There's no justification for holding it back and not disclosing it. And yet, the agency that's producing it and the oversight committee that's receiving it isn't producing this stuff. If you look at the White House visitors' logs as a model for this sort of automatic, regular disclosure of information that's produced in common data sets, I think you're probably looking at a scenario in which other agencies can look to this as a model. Now, one of the issues here is, well, is it mandated by statute? Is it simply an executive policy? You know, and certainly you want binding, neutral statutory requirements. Having said that, the White House did this without a statute. They went ahead and did it as a matter of policy. And if what it's going to take to get this data disclosed and get it disclosed in these digital accessible forms is to simply have an executive order or have an executive policy in place, well, I think we can live with that moving forward. That's pretty much where we are in terms of data that's being produced by the White House and how that might be used for some of the analysis that Tom Blanton talked about. Now we move on to some of the inherited issues. And Dan brought up one of them, the state secrets privilege. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about that over the last week or so. The administration has issued new guidance on the use of the privilege. It has affirmatively not applied that new guidance to pending cases. Some of these pending cases involve some of the biggest issues in the transparency community right now, the warrantless wiretapping program, the Office of Legal Counsel memos that justify the basis for the program or purport to justify the basis for that program. And unfortunately, this administration has not only continue the Bush administration's assertion of the state secrets privilege regarding those cases. It has actively reasserted that privilege in these cases. I personally don't see a legitimate basis for it, and perhaps I'm biased, but the reality is that the news on this front is not as good as it is on some of the other fronts in terms of transparency with this administration. As Dan pointed out, when these sorts of things are subject to the whim of the administration or executive policy, and they are not subject to statutory requirement in a binding binding law, you can run into these problems. The State Secrets Act has been the subject of much discussion in terms State Secrets Privilege has been the subject of a lot of discussion in terms of reforming. And there are pending bills in Congress. Some were introduced last term. We had a new one, H.R. 984, that's been got reintroduced this term. And that's, those laws, one of which is entitled State Secrets Protection Act of 2009, essentially codifies a lot of the same principles that are covered by the administration's guidance on this issue. We did ask the question of an administration official whether or not the recent policy is intended to head off the legislation. And the official was absolutely candid, though they were unwilling to speak on the record, and said no, it was not meant to blunt legislation. The administration has not taken an official position on any bill, but the intent of the administration's policy at this stage is not to head off legislation. Well, it seems to me that everybody in this room has an interest in having a law governing state secrets moving forward that a future administration can't easily withdraw or append or simply ignore. Finally, I'm going to get on to one inherited issue, which is going to move very well, I think, into Miriam's talk, which is the OGIS. And as all of you know, the OGIS was established by the Open Government Act of 2007. It was intended to be housed in the archives. The previous administration did attempt to house it in the Department of Justice, which has a somewhat checkered history on some of these issues. So it is doubly good news, not only that we have someone like Miriam running this very important office, but that it is housed where it ought to be housed in an independent oversight.
Thank you. It's a very nice segue.
Nice endorsement, huh?
Yes, I appreciate that. I would like to point out that it is only 20 calendar days. I haven't hit the 20 working days yet.
Oh,
to deliver.
Wait, are you implying that you have not been working every one of those 20 days? Because I know you, and I'm certain you have been. Those have been 20 working days for you without any doubt.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the faith. Thank you for the express. What I'd like to do is just talk a little bit about the office and what I hope that we're going to do as a good example and a good model for what the United States should be doing, even though, as we've all heard today, in some cases, in many cases, we are really behind on what a lot of countries have done in terms of having an ombuds office to deal with for you. I'm sure most of you are familiar with this, but let me just recap a little bit about what the office is intended to do. There are really two express statutory responsibilities that are laid out in the 2007 FOIA amendments. One is really to provide oversight of agency performance. It's really sort of that compliance aspect. It's the office is intended to specifically make recommendations on improvement to Congress and the President. That would be procedurally and policy wise. The other function is what's being called mediation, because the statute specifically says, or expressly says, that the office will provide mediation services to resolve disputes between FOIA requesters and agencies as a non-exclusive alternative to litigation. So it's not something that is required. But rather it is something that certainly Congress hopes and this administration hopes will really cut down on litigation, save agencies, save requesters. How are we going to do that? I'll talk about that in just a minute. Taking those two functions together, the oversight, the policy procedure, the mediation, is really, I think, what leads to Congress and many people referring to this office as the ombudsman, even though that word is not used in the statute. I think in that respect, my understanding, my impression, and my hope is that our office will be able to provide, I would like to say, mediation all along the way in the FOIA process. The whole idea is to improve the process, not to have some sort of a formal point at which people can come. And when I say that, people, either government agencies or FOIA requesters, come and say, okay, will you provide mediation services, but rather to be able to intervene, to help clear up misunderstandings, small, simple, or complex, at any stage of the process. I think that might be a little ambitious, but I think that's what Congress intended, and I think that's what we're called for.
Miriam, given that we have two of what we describe as the grandparents of the legislation here in the audience, which would be Patrice McDermott and Rick Bloom, who I think correct on it and very forcefully advocated for it.
At least he's not calling you the great-grandparent.
That was an upgrade from what I called Cal, who's the information commissioner from Sweden. I hope you caught that, Patrice. Okay. They will disagree with you if they see it differently, but the very fact that they're not even grimacing at all means that what you're suggesting is right on the button.
I hope so. Now, how are we going to do this? Right now, you are looking at the Office of Government Affairs, but I have been interviewing like crazy for 2 weeks, trying to hire a staff. There will be 6 of us to begin with. And I say to begin with because I really think that this is a pretty big mandate. I think it's an important mandate. I have heard very strong support already in this short amount of time from the Open Government Initiative at the White House, certainly from Congress, and I think everybody really wants this to work. That having been said, we're probably going to be finding ourselves with not quite enough resources if we're talking about doing this government-wide. So, my idea is that we're going to, we're certainly going to build on existing resources. We're going to use certainly mediation, mediators within the government. I'd like us to have a pool of non-government mediators as well that would be available to help. Technology, definitely this is a place that calls for technology. I've already been talking to some experts on online dispute resolution to see how we might be able to use some online tools to do that. Similarly, I would love to see the data about agency performance available in a format that lots of those creative people out there can take and use and turn into a really good analysis of how agencies are doing. I think that would be helpful to the government. It will be helpful to the government agencies. It will be helpful to the public. And I think there are a lot of different ways that those data can be used that maybe are not being used now to just tell us where the problems are and do some real comparisons. So I'm going to stop right there about the Office of Government Information Services because I'd like to just very quickly talk about a more international slant. And as Dan said, I've just come from 2 years with the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. It is the only agency within the United Nations that has as its mandate freedom of expression. I couldn't agree more that the freedom of expression, the freedom of speech aspect is absolutely critical. If you have the information but you can't use it, I don't know. I think maybe in this country we're a little bit isolated from, protected from the fact that there are journalists being killed every single day in this world because they are trying to report, because they're trying to express, because they're trying to use the information that they are trying very hard to get and want to be able to speak about and write about. It's a huge, huge issue. The education piece, I also would very much agree. The changing the culture of secrecy is probably one of the most difficult things that can be done. One of the ways, though, that I think that institutions, whether governmental, international governmental, nonprofit are finding, though, that is particularly helpful in changing some of the culture, particularly in developing countries, is really working with the idea of using information for development. That information, right to information, access to information is not just, it is good government. It is, you know, something that we all, certainly in the United States, it's a foundation of how our government operates. That's not true in a lot of places, but if we can change the way people are thinking about how important access to information is to develop businesses, to improve the communication within schools among the citizens, that can go a long way towards providing an incentive that may that you may not be able to provide just by saying this is good for everybody, this is good government, it's good for democracy. But if you can talk about, and it's really true, that access to information changes people's lives in terms of their quality of life, overcoming poverty, educating people, that definitely helps. In this regard, the leadership internationally of libraries and archives has been really huge, and I can't say enough about that. I have to admit I'm a bit prejudiced coming from both the library and the archival community, but particularly the leadership that libraries have shown in terms of bringing connectivity to schools and to public libraries, using public libraries as real access points for communities. So we talk about the original community technology center, the community information center, that's libraries. That's been really huge. And the United States government has long had a very good track record in supporting those efforts. I just want to close with a point that Kevin made. Having been living out of the United States for 2 years, I can tell you that people are incredibly interested in what's happening in the United States now with President Obama. People are so excited, and they really, the interest in the election last year was just, I cannot overstate it. I got a little concerned when people started coming to me and saying, can you explain the Iowa caucuses? Now the pressure is on. No, I can't. but people were that interested in the minutiae and what happened. People were so excited about the election. So this is a moment in time that we really have to take advantage of, and I'm confident we will.
Rebuttal, but addendum, perhaps.
said that Matt across the board was, admittedly, I'm a little biased. Each of us had our biases, but I think overall the message was the same.
I think the one thing about biases is that they're transparent.
Would it be fair to say that all of you see this glass as half full, not half empty?
Oh, yeah.
And that it's only a matter of time before things improve? Okay, leaving that positive note, and let me ask John just to start questions off, because there may be more questions in the audience as well. You mentioned state secrets and carrying over Bush administration positions and the new policy, and that surprisingly, I think, the new policy does not apply to pending litigation cases, including some in which perhaps the most extreme Bush administration positions on sacred secrecy were ever taken, such as the Jefferson case in the Ninth Circuit. You didn't mention anything about freedom of information policy, specifically the Holder Memorandum in March that was the counterpart to what came out in state secrets privilege last week, and its applicability or not to pending litigation. How do you see that?
You know, it's a very good question.
Thank you.
I certainly, in a similar way, with the state secrets policy, the Holder Memorandum moving forward is obviously a very good thing. In terms of applicability to pending cases, I have not been, unlike the state secrets privilege, I have not been involved in a case that goes to a lot of the key issues in the Holder Memorandum. So I can't speak to it. I would toss it out to folks in the room whether you have. I have not.
Yeah, well, it just so happens I haven't, having published an article on this point, I am aware of the fact that there's a tremendous difference between the Reno Memorandum, which Miriam will remember, we implemented like heck just as you were leaving Office of Information Privacy over to the archives, which said explicitly, here's the standard for the application of this new foreseeable harm policy to pending cases. Quote, the word all. That was it, a one-word standard. All pending cases. And it was implemented like gangbusters for that. We were able to waive that. When I say waive, I mean up in the air. As an example, to encourage other agencies to get the message, Justice Department was walking the walk, not just talking the talk. The counterpart portion of the Holder Memorandum is a sentence, a single sentence, that, believe it or not, has no fewer than six hedges as to applicability to pending cases, not the least of which is the phrase impracticable. And even lawyers and non-lawyers alike know what that means in government, and also involved the client agency counsel in reaching the judgment as to whether to even conduct a Reno litigation review under the policy. And you know what it's like to litigate against the federal government. If you have CIA counsel having a voice, if not a veto, in that process, what's the result going to be? So on the face of the memo itself, it's doomed to fail in that respect. And that's why you haven't heard about the type of disclosures in 2009 that we had in 1993, 1994. I guess I'm testifying rather than interrogating. So I'll stop doing that. But that's true, isn't it?
Yeah. I do not disagree.
Objection, Your Honor, compound question. Okay, fine. Questions from the audience, more succinctly than perhaps that one. There's one in the back row, and I know we have this gentleman up here as well. Yes, sir, you in the far end of the room. You have to speak very loud.
A question to put Miriam on the spot.
She's on the spot just being here, Will. Make no mistake about that. And she also will be on the spot on Wednesday because, believe it or not, Miriam has been on the job for 20 calendar days, which also were 20 working days, as I said. On the 22nd calendar and working day, Wednesday, she's being hauled up before the full Senate Judiciary Committee to testify on a FOIA implementation hearing. So Congress has made has not wasted any time to make it clear how much they're interested in what she's doing. And, of course, it's not oversight in the usual sense. It's just a show of support. Right, Mary? Absolutely, yes.
That's exactly the way I'm typing
it. A show of support.
I guess the question goes to Miriam, but if the others have information or insight to comment as well. But my question is, how do you envision your role at OGIS vis-a-vis the Office of Information Policy and Justice? And how do you envision, managing that relationship in terms of OIP's oversight role And then I guess in particular their ombudsman role, which has, in my experience, has never been a robust element for that office. And I just wonder how you foresee working with OIP and areas of potential overlap or turf or other issues. Thank you.
We're going to work it out, and I'm sure that we can. There's no way around it. I mean, OIP has been for playing the oversight role and the policy role for 25 years, more than 25 years, I think.
Since 1981, yes.
And still clearly has authority in that area. When you look at the statute, it's invites the question that you just asked. How are we going to work this out? So the first thing we do is we start talking, which we've already done. We try and figure out how we can work together. I think that we have to work together. There's a whole body of guidance, procedurally and policy-wise, out there. I think it's going to be very, very confusing if the offices are not working together. Clearly, you can't have one office saying this is the way it must be, and another office saying this is the way it must be, but rather trying to give advice that is coherent and understanding to the FOIA officers and to the FOIA requesters. So we're just going to have to work our way through it. And that's about all I can tell you at this point because, you know, it's too soon to tell. However, I feel like we should have every expectation that we're going to be able to fulfill the intent of law.
Especially if she's able to persuade the Justice Department to amend the question of the application of the Holder Memorandum to pending cases, which would go a long way toward helping and facilitating that ombudsman function. But that is my interjection. It is one to which Miriam is certainly not expected to respond. There was another question. Yes, sir, here.
Sir, basically, I believe that to assume role of leadership, you have two aspects to cover. One is to serve as a model for the rest of the world. And secondly, you have to help practically different institutions, different countries, to go for that openness. So that is how you assume the role of a leader. Now, as far as first aspect is concerned, I think US is quite advanced. And what you have been doing here, that is definitely an example for the rest of the world. And that is also one of the reasons that I am here from Pakistan, to study right to information, a comparative study of US and Pakistan, because we want to learn from your model. Now, as far as other aspect is concerned, to help practically different countries, different institutions to be more open. Now, here I feel that a new potential has arisen, that electronic media in the developing world, which is usually traditionally closed societies, now electronic media, satellite television, and that sort of thing are opening up those societies. So if US institutions, if United States government, as well as non-governmental organizations, institutions, can collaborate with their counterparts in the developing world, especially, to train journalists, because at the moment, not as Kevin very rightly said, that most of the people, they are not educated. Literacy is very low. But right to information is now being provided to them through media, through journalists. That media is playing that role to provide that information to a common illiterate man. So is there any possibility of exploring or even thinking about that aspect, that now when those countries are facing a large demand for journalists, there are potential for new journalists to join profession, and harvest that opportunity and train them in a proper investigative journalism manner, telling them that these are the ways that this is how you can get information. So I was more concerned about this aspect of leadership to help practically to the underdeveloped country.
I mean, actually, Dan asked me, do you have an answer to that one?
Well, only that UNESCO does, in fact, provide training for journalists in conjunction with a number of organizations, particularly those, you know, International Society of Journalists.
You know, I originally, Dan looked at me and he said, do you have anything to you know, you want to take this one? And I said, well, I'm just going to agree with everything he said.
Yeah.
Since he was agreeing with everything I said. I actually do have a thought, and that's that I caution against making that a U.S. government issue. We probably don't want government directly training our journalists any more than we want government licensing our journalists in this country. And let me tell you, we don't want that. I think the government has a role to play. There can be government participation in the process and government endorsement of these as key priorities. We, you know, it's always been in every administration has its matter of which things are they going to prioritize. Are you going to prioritize national defense over domestic policy? Are you going to, you know, what are you going to do? What will be your issues? I would love to see freedom of speech and the ability to budget for things like freedom of speech through the embassies. And, you know, a lot of civil society groups won't take money directly, but the ability of allowing, or, you know, finding private money into private organizations and government money through the embassies into, you know, making this a key part of the programs, as high as public health and things like that, to support it all.
Just clarify that. Actually, when I was talking about the institutions, like the CGS, this is an institution. And now it can provide a lot of support to different universities in the South Asian countries. Similarly, I went to visit Poynter Institute in Florida. Now that's doing a wonderful job, investigative journalism training. Now if these institutions and endowments, they can be convinced that for this cause, if they can contribute something, that can be a wonderful opportunity for the United States to assume that leadership role.
Right. Well, I agree, and I think that's what I'm saying, is that we have that inherent problem in having government, that we don't want government directly doing the training, but we do want government to sort of nudge either other governments to be receptive to the idea. And within our own country, we need all of us to sort of find the money to get into journalism training or sort of legal training programs. Which is as big a problem as just about anything now.
To support organizations like the Poynter Institute.
Yeah.
Rather than, because on Miriam's behalf, thank you. In New Jersey, the number is Bigelow 255. In Miriam's defense, see, Kevin is just barely old enough to remember that. From the early 50s or the mid 50s?
Yeah, that's probably mid-50s is
everything. In Miriam's defense, in the defense of her office, OGIS at NARA, to throw around these acronyms, those are FLAs, right? Four major acronyms?
Yeah.
Okay. She's got her hands full just dealing with, for lack of a better phrase, the third world countries that consist of some of the agencies of the United States government. Because sometimes, even nowadays, even with the culture change that has occurred in this country now for more than 40 years, it's still difficult in some situations, maybe a lot of situations, to bring agency officials, political and career, kicking and screaming into the sunlight, so to speak. So you can't quite expect OGIS, to be playing that international role, at least not so heavily right yet. Now, at the speed at which Miriam is going, especially given that she's testifying to her full Senate Judiciary Committee in 2 days, she might be up to that by December. But you have to give her a little bit of time for that. Were there any more questions in the back? There's someone, how about in the fourth corner right there? That probably will be our last question. Because speaking of timeliness, we're coming up just to about 4:30. We obviously have extended this program because there's so much interest in our large audience. Go ahead, please, ma'am, in the far corner.
Yes, this question is for Miriam. A lot of people have been disappointed with the Obama administration so far, and some people have been happy with what's been going on with the Obama administration so far. My question is, how long do you think, ultimately, that it will take for the Obama administration to be in full swing to replace the secrecy with the transparency across the board?
Don't accept that in units of days, minutes, and hours, I believe.
But I do know, again, based upon the support that has been expressed to me in the short time that I've been here, almost 3 weeks, for this office. I mean, it's a little office, I think symbolically, the fact that it's been funded, the fact that it's going to be up and running, the fact that it's very much supported by Congress and the White House and the agencies. I think symbolically that says we want to use every tool we can for transparency. Changing all the policies about secrecy, making all those adjustments is not something that happens very quickly. But I go back to the directive that came out the first day of business in this administration, making it very, very clear that this was an administration for transparency, for openness, for setting an example, and certainly for using all tools at disposal to make a difference. It's a great start.
John looked like he had a coda to add to that. I wasn't sure.
I would encourage everyone to examine the premise of that question, which is that the Obama administration wants to replace the Bush administration's secrecy with transparency across the board.
Ouch.
I think across the board is very strong language. And given some of the decisions, the affirmative decisions, the active decisions that this administration has made, I don't know whether that desire is there. I do think that there is a genuine desire for much more transparency and secrecy. I don't know if that extends to across the board.
Well, at least at the playing board, so to speak, is the realm of the new Office of Government Information Services. I don't think any of us could have any doubt whatsoever that that is the full and complete aim of the Obama administration, and that'll just take a little while to see that, but everyone will see that in the fullness of time. And on that far more positive note, the glass being half full rather than half empty, let me thank not only our panels here, but the audience. Please give yourself a big round of applause. Your kind attention and your very interesting and stimulating questions during this program, and we hope to see you all at the 4th Annual International Right to Know Day celebration on September 28, 2010, and perhaps at some CGS programs between now and then on November 18, January 20th, and March 16th. And until then, remember, it's good for you. Thank you.